I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, a story that hasn't been told. One of the key characters in Tommy Orange's new novel, There, There, takes up a storytelling project that Orange himself once pursued. The character asks Native Americans who live in the city to tell the story of what it means to be an urban Indian, to describe an identity long forgotten or ignored. That project becomes the powerful core of a novel of disparate voices and experiences. Tommy Orange's new novel is a must-read of the summer. It's titled There, There, and he joins me in the studio. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, it occurred to me as I was reading the title of the novel in front of you that I was putting an inflection in it that maybe wasn't the inflection that you added to the title. So how do you say the title, and why do you say it the way you do?
I just say it pretty straightforward, There, There. I don't have the, you know, the comforting, I don't know if you thought of it in the comforting way. Yes,
yeah.
A lot of people have said that, and I have to tell them that it's not a very comforting novel.
I mean, I also think of it as there's no there there.
That's where the title comes from the Gertrude Stein quote.
Why is it specifically not there there comforting?
There's not very much comforting about, I mean, for some readers, and for Native readers specifically, I've found that there's light and hope in it, but there's a lot of people that are just sort of devastated by it. So it's not comforting. And some of the things that I talk about are just not, it's uncomfortable, and it should be. It's something that we haven't been able to look at.
Yeah, deliberately uncomforting, right?
Yeah.
So when you say to people, or when people say to you, I wasn't prepared for the how uncomfortable this would be, how painful this would be to read, you say by design.
Yeah. I think there's been a convenient looking away from a lot that has to do with our history. And there's been a systematic, institutionalized way of talking about history that glorifies what it's been. And Native people know what happened and what it feels like, and how that plays out over time, intergenerational trauma-wise. But we're just now coming to a place where it seems people are open to thinking about it.
And why is that?
I think it's related to this administration, and just there's a lot of people waking up to what this country is and where it comes from. I think when you get into a situation like we're in, you can't help but look back and wonder how we got here. And in that looking back, if you're willing to go far enough, you'll realize it's never been great.
You've said that the stories of urban Native people haven't been told in white America, but it also sounds like they haven't really been told among Native communities either. Why?
Not on this level. I mean, there are people that have done it. There are books that I've found out about after I wrote it. People have called it to my attention, so I don't want to sound like nobody's done
have
it.
Have they called it to your attention because
I've
heard you saying?
Yeah, because I've said, and it's true that I didn't know of any, and I really sought it out. You know, I scoured the internet looking for books that talked about the urban Indian experience, and I personally just couldn't find it, and that's, you know, my own fault. Maybe I wasn't looking in the right places.
But why, let's just say those stories are hard to find,
mm-hmm.
And then why are they hard to find?
Well, because there's a historical monolithic image of the Indian, and there's either the one that's before reservations, which is just like, you know, the cowboy and Indian one from 50s and 60s films, or there's the reservation literature that and movies that have come out when we are visible. There's two dominant versions of us, and I think it's convenient to think of us in the past tense and not here anymore. And some people don't know, a lot of people don't even know a single Native person. I mean, Minneapolis and around here, it's different because there's more of a visible population. In places like New Mexico and Arizona and Oklahoma and Montana, people tend to know that they're Native people. But there's a lot of places where, you know, people say, oh, they're still here, or, you know, I've never met a Native person before. And so to have a big portion of the country think that we don't even exist anymore, I can't begin to even describe what kind of damage that does to us as far as being able to, you know, get the help that we need. I mean, not that we need help and we're helpless, but like...
You catch yourself on that, right?
Yeah.
Because that's not the, that's also not the image that you want to leave us with.
But if we're, you know, if we can't see ourselves depicted as modern and present tense people, it does a lot of damage as far as building a strong sense of self and community. And, you know, we don't grow up having role models on TV or in movies or, you know, barely in literature.
A couple things that that you've said that I want to ask you about. Some of the reason that people don't have, what, daily interactions with Native Americans is because of the deliberate isolation of the reservations, right? And the lack of knowledge about what it is to be on the reservation, to call that space home. And I say deliberate, right? That this is, as it was designed, has kind of reaped the consequences of that design, right?
Yeah, and then the next step after reservations was relocation, and it was part of the Indian termination policy, and it was to move Native people to cities and have them assimilate and sort of disappear. And that was supposed to be the next step and sort of final step, but that didn't happen. We found each other in cities and started up Indian centers all over the country, and we've been in cities for generations. And there's families that call cities like New York and L.A. and Minneapolis and Oakland home.
You also talked about this image from the 50s and 60s of cowboys and Indians. You know, you live out west, right? You live in Seattle?
No, in California.
In California. Mm-hmm. So there's a real unwillingness to let go of that imagery of what the West is, even today. So when you challenge that, you're challenging a mythology that is really dear to Americans about what the West is. Tell me how you think that through.
Well, you know, I live in a small mining town where Mark Twain is the hero, and my son goes to Mark Twain Elementary.
Is that right?
So the mythology is alive and well, and he was famously terrible in regards to Native people, just said really awful things. And, you know, with Trump and his favorite president being Jackson, mm-hmm. and the mythology is alive and well. And so writing into and against that mythology with this novel is, and the fact that it's getting a lot of attention and a big readership, it's one way that we can help counteract some of that damaging mythology.
What do you tell your son about the namesake of the school that he attends?
We've explained to him a lot of awful things about Mark Twain. just in a, you know, he's only 7, so. But we're clear with him about what's what.
And what is what?
So an article came out in the Paris Review. I'll just tell you the headline. I don't want to go into the details.
Okay.
You can look it up yourself. Mark Twain collected young girls ages 10 to 16. And it goes into a lot of details about this horrific thing. Called him his angel fish and built a house in Connecticut. He called the aquarium. So there's statues and,
wow,
and his face everywhere in our town. And people still celebrate. I mean, there's tons of schools named after him still. This is one of the, you know, he's one of our American heroes. And I wrote a very short 150 word thing for GQ about, they asked us to write about some piece of literature that gets taught that we don't need to read and what to read instead. Mm-hmm. And I just wrote a very short thing. Didn't even go into the angelfish thing. Just said he was racist. Referenced this Colombian author, and the comment section in Twitter went crazy and went after me for challenging their hero. And there's a lot of these institutionalized founding fathers that who are awful, and there's no reason to not look at the truth of who they were, and we don't need to have them be heroes. We can move on as a country together and, you know, look into the past wide-eyed. We don't need to keep painting it as something that was glorious.
You know, this is brave and exhausting work, right? To take on myths, and I know that's what the novel is all about. I know you've thought about that a lot. I don't know that even people like me appreciate what it's like to write against it, talk against it, raise awareness against it. So what's it like?
Well, I think the writing part, now that I've experienced the public life part, is I prefer.
You prefer the writing to the public life part?
Yes.
Tell me why. I mean, you're surely meeting people who are saying this novel opened my eyes, or it's deeply meaningful to me. So that's got to be fulfilling.
Definitely. The talking to readers part is great, and the bookstores and the signings, it's all really amazing to feel the love directly. But I'm much more comfortable considering my words and really constructing sentences in a thoughtful way with time, and so
than having to react in the moment.
Yeah, it's I'm already uncomfortable just being in public or talking to people, just anybody. So to be asked to speak off the top of the head about things that are really important is uncomfortable for me, because I'm used to doing it just on the page where I have time.
So far, so good here.
Yeah.
Or are you squirming and uncomfortable? No.
I mean, I've done my best to not seem like I'm squirming and uncomfortable.
One of the other things that I think you're writing into, to use your phrase, is this idea within the Native community, and Sherman Alexie talks a lot about this, has talked about it with me and on the show, that there is one way to be Native. And if you color outside the lines of that, or you criticize that ideal, you are in for some really harsh criticism and backlash from within the Native community. Aren't you raising some questions about this idea that there's one way to be Native American?
Yeah, and I think I'm open to dialogue and conversation about it, but even, this blood idea of blood quantum, and the fact that I'm half white and half Native and from the city and not the reservation, just me as a person already automatically colors outside of some lines. But I think...
Whose lines, though?
I know.
This is what we're talking about.
And a lot of them are non-Native. You know, a lot of it has to do with thinking that the one way to be Native is to act or look like the Native that we know. And the problem is that we're dynamic. We have a dynamic range of types of people, ways that we look. And because we don't have depictions of ourselves with that range, it's like we're gone before we can even get here, as far as the way people think about us. So it's a dicey conversation to get in around what it means, because it means different things to a lot of different people. We're 570 something nations, and that would come with different histories and languages and different ways of thinking about how to be human. And I'm not here to say that I'm writing a way. I'm just saying that this is a range that I've experienced, and I wrote a book explaining some of that. I certainly don't want to be a new voice who's saying, no, this is how to be Indian, because
I don't read that in the novel. Do you feel like that's how it's being received?
No, it's just a risk because we don't get a lot of attention on a national level, and I am. So that just automatically puts me in that position, and I fear that because I don't want that at all.
You fear that because it might be interpreted that you have now come up with the new way to be Native, and the attention span is short.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And you're having a moment on this, mm-hmm. and you don't want to leave the wrong idea.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that my success will mean more success for more Native artists in general, and that if publishers and people who make the decisions around who gets through to this level can see that there's a large portion of this country that people are ready to hear about Native stories. my biggest hope would be that it would open doors for a lot of other voices and expand the range, the dynamic range of who we are.
You know, it's enough. I mean, it's huge that the novel is on so many lists and you're talking to people like me and the word's getting out about the novel. It's a lot of weight for you to also take on to say, I'm having my moment and this is being received in a way that maybe I couldn't have dreamed of. And now I want to make sure that the moment doesn't really end for other writers. I guess that's a responsibility too for you. So how do you think about it?
Well, I think there hasn't ever been a program like the Institute of American Indian Arts, and that's where I teach. Mm-hmm. And having an institution that is on a yearly basis, students are coming through the program and entering the world and trying to get their books out. And having an institution is big for sustainability, and so that this isn't just some, you know, wave that recedes. I think having more institutions like it and promoting each other's work and, you know, getting student work through to the right people is one way that can help it sustain and not just be, you know, this wave that we've seen waves before where Native writers have become popular, but for some reason it always recedes. So I want to try to find ways to keep it sustained.
I mean, Sherman Alexie was the exception to that. And now we know with the allegations of sexual harassment against him, for now his career has receded. He took up a lot of space. I mean, in some ways, in that realm that you're talking about, in some ways, does that leave more space for other writers to step into, paving the way for some of these new writers that you're teaching?
Yeah, well, you know, it's what I want to do, so time will tell if I'll be successful at that. But
do you agree with what I said about Sherman taking up a lot of room in that space? I mean that as a Native writer, he was somebody who I don't know, sucked up a lot of the oxygen, mm-hmm. right? Of the canon, I guess, of Native writers. I'm not saying that's how it should be, but it seems like how it was.
Yeah.
And now with him off the stage, at least for now, I guess I'm wondering if that opens up some space.
Yeah, and I am actively going to try not to be a single voice that fills up the space.
Understood.
Because there's already been people talking in with language like that, just sort of the Sherman Alexie replacement or whatever, any language that's referring to me as you know, passing the baton was something that came up in the New York Times review of my book.
And that's too narrow, right, for what you want.
Yes, yeah. So I'm going to do what I can, and I teach at the school that I teach at, and mm-hmm. And I have close relationships with other Native writers like Therese Myatt, who wrote
Heartberries.
She was
on the show, yeah. Uh-huh. Wonderful memoir.
Yes.
And others.
Yeah. Therese and I are going to try to... We both have had conversations about actively taking steps to make sure this isn't just a wave and that it is sustainable.
Tommy Orange is in the studio with me this morning. His new novel is, raising a lot of buzz and being read throughout the country through the summer, I hope. It is titled There, There, and we're having a conversation about some of the ideas and his philosophy on writing. There's a character in the novel, Dean Oxendine, am I pronouncing that right?
Yep.
Who gets this grant for these stories. And as he's making his argument to the grant committee, he wants to record urban Native Americans about their experience without any specific idea of what their stories have to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he says to the grant committee, "What we've seen is full of the kinds of stereotypes that are the reason no one is interested in the Native story in general. It's too sad. So sad it can't even be entertaining." He also says that he thinks Native people themselves perpetuate that. Is that something you believe?
Perpetuate stereotypes?
No, perpetuate this idea that there's one story and it's sad and it's so sad it can never be entertaining.
I was having him talk to the panelists in a way that was heartfelt and that would persuade them to give him the grant. It was more coming from that. It's not my opinion on the matter.
And yet you said that this is a novel that is deliberately not comforting. Mm-hmm. It's sad.
Yeah.
Right? It's provoking.
But I also did my best to actually have it be entertaining.
It is entertaining. Would you read an excerpt from that part of the novel?
Sure.
Again, this is Dean in front of the grant committee making the case to get this grant so that he can go around and record stories of urban Native Americans.
"You going for the grant?" the guy says to Dean. Dean nods and sticks his hand out for a shake. "Dean," he says. "Rob," the guy says. "Where are you from?" Dean says. "Actually, I don't have a place right now, but next month me and some friends are getting a place in West Oakland. It's dirt cheap over there," Rob says. Dean clenches his jaw and blinks a slow blink at this. Dirt cheap. "Did you grow up here?" Dean says. "I mean, no one's really from here, right?" Rob says. "What?" "You know what I mean." "I do know what you mean," Dean says. "You know that Gertrude Stein... You know what Gertrude Stein said about Oakland?" Rob says. Dean shakes his head no, but actually knows. Actually Googled quotes about Oakland when researching for his project. He knows exactly what the guy is about to say. "There is no there," he says in a kind of whisper, with this goofy open-mouth smile Dean wants to punch. Dean wants to tell him he'd looked up the quote in its original context, in her Everybody's autobiography, and found that she was talking about how the place where she'd grown up in Oakland had changed so much, that so much development had happened there, that the there of her childhood, the there was gone. There was no there anymore.
Tommy Orange, reading from his new novel, There. I was thinking about what it means to tell a story and then what it means to take in that story. And this balance between the telling and the listening. And in some ways, I think you might be saying there's been a lot of telling of the stories. There hasn't been a lot of listening. And whether we're in a moment where there's a willingness of a receptivity to this kind of listening. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, if it feels that way. Just recently,
does it?
I can't help but agree with that because of how well the book is doing. And, you know, Teresa and I, graduated at the same time and sold our books within 2 weeks of each other and both made the New York Times bestseller list. And that has to mean something. And Lely Long Soldiers, Whereas has gotten amazing attention. And, I have to agree that it means something, that people are wanting to really, I think there's also something with form and the way we're all doing something a little bit different and modern with form.
How so?
Just challenging it. All of us have done something with structure, the structure of our books and the way that we're writing that feels new, and maybe something to do with that. And also the receptivity based on the political climate.
Mm-hmm. But let's talk a bit more about the form. What makes it modern?
Well, for my book, just having Native characters who are texting each other and flying drones and using Facebook and having it feel very contemporary. It's just not something that's happened very much. And I did that deliberately to have people know, just sort of get an update on. It sounds trite to me whenever I start to say anything that sounds like we're still here. But like I've already said, the sad truth of it is that people don't consider that we are. And that our heads are still on jerseys and they're unwilling to take them off. They're unwilling to challenge that mythology.
Why does that sound trite to you?
Well, in the Native community, we've just heard it a lot. And so I'm often listening with other Native people's ears, it just sounds annoying to me because I've heard it a lot.
Does that mean that you catch yourself stepping back, or I don't know, even censoring yourself in some ways of what you feel needs to be said? And then you imagine, I don't know, a friend in the Native community going, come on, dude, really?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm censoring myself. I'm just considering the Native audience always and want to be speaking to them and not, you know, not speaking to white people or non-Native people, because I wrote the book with a Native audience in mind. I was writing it for half of the time in a Native writing community and getting feedback from them and reading to them at the school. And censoring it makes it sound like I'm afraid of what I'll say to them.
You're right. Too strong of a word. Do you find yourself using some caution, I guess, in the way you speak about what I think you feel is a pretty necessary message to the white audiences as well that are reading this?
Yeah, I just want to find a way to speak to both audiences. I'm not trying to isolate either one, but I want to consider both, because there's a way to, sometimes when Native people are asked questions, there's a way to have to answer only to non-Native people who haven't heard anything before.
Can you think of an example?
Well, you know, something like "We're still here." It's an old, you know, something that we've heard a lot in Native communities. Or like resiliency is a word that most Natives now will roll their eyes at. But, you know, some non-Native people who hear it for the first time think it's a great thing. There's a litany of these examples that I can't think of now, but I know them as soon as they occur to me. Uh-huh. Because of the context of talking to a non-Native person, there's a lot of new information. Some of the feedback that I've gotten from readers is just, they're just thanking me for all the new information that they didn't know about. And a lot of Native people, what I was trying to do in the prologue was present information I knew that people knew about in a in a compelling way, in a way that you would still feel it even though you already knew it.
Mm-hmm. Back to the storytelling idea and what it means to take in stories and listen to stories. I was having a conversation with the poet Joy Harjo, and we were talking about a certain kind of listening to music and storytelling. And here's what she said about that.
Poetry, music, it's about discovery and about leading. It's about mystery. Right. And, yeah, about going to the place of what you don't know and what you can't hear.
So what does that raise for you?
Well, I was a musician before I was a writer. Started playing guitar when I was 18. Hmm. I didn't write when I was young, or didn't do well in school. And then I got into the piano when I was 21. And so I'm always thinking about rhythm in regards to sentences. And I like what she's saying about discovery and mystery. Writing fiction for me is a very mysterious process. And I think there's a bigger, deeper understanding being inside me that's at work, especially with something like a novel. Mm-hmm. And putting in the time and getting to the page and really thinking about on a sentence level the rhythm of each character and how to make their voices distinct. It feels very musical to me. But I have a relationship with music.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear you talk about more about the rhythm of the characters than I think you can see rhythm and language in a lot of different writing, but it's interesting to hear you say there was a musicality, what, to the way the characters would reveal themselves, or how?
No, it's more the way, you know, I read out loud a lot to kind of get a feel for the sentences. It has to do with making, since I wrote a novel with so many characters, I really did a lot of work to make sure their voices sounded distinct from one another, because otherwise you risk losing the reader and confusing the reader. So I thought a lot about how a sentence felt, and it was pretty instinctual and rhythmic feeling when during the editing process. I have a lot of long sentences too, and I think they're to make a long sentence work, you really have to work the rhythm in it.
Explain.
Well, a long sentence can, you know, you risk losing the reader if it doesn't feel right, if it doesn't make the reader want to keep reading further into the sentence. It can be exhausting, or it can be annoying, or you can lose the train of thought. There's a lot of risks to a long sentence, but if you keep a rhythm that's compelling, even though it's nobody's maybe going to think about that while they're reading. as a writer, it was important to me to try to make sure it felt right.
So I've talked about this with a number of writers, this way that you have to trust the reader, you know, in a way that you're not being over-explanatory. You know what I mean? You don't want to be too explicit, but in order for the reader to decide, I don't know, a page and a half, that's about where I decide. I'm a page and a half in whether I'm deciding to trust this writer. And then the writer can do a lot of different things, and I'm there. So how much, I mean, is that something that occurs to you as a writer, where the reader is as they're entering into your experience in your writing?
Yeah, there was a big shift for me. The beginning of my writing life, I wrote a lot of weird and experimental stuff that was not very accessible to anyone but me. and at some point, I'm not sure why this came to me, but just this deep consideration of the reader and wanting to meet the reader halfway there and trusting the reader. And to really write something that was very readable and enjoyable to read, even if I was writing about something that is uncomfortable to find out about. So this deep consideration of the reader, it was a big transformation in my writing that happened about halfway through maybe writing the novel.
Huh. So you're writing inaccessible, short stories, or you're working on an inaccessible in what way?
Just
there's no
very
logic
internal
or?
And not very much is happening. And, you know, it's just like maybe language that loves itself too much or something. I don't know.
What's language that loves itself too much? Let me look out for that in future reading. What is it?
Maybe it's clear that I don't make a point to go back and read old writing, but maybe it's clear that the writer is having too much fun, you know, with the sentence and not considering having a story move. I think a story needs movement, and you want the reader to come along. And reading, you know, books wouldn't be without both the reader and the writer. So I think having a deep consideration for that relationship is important.
I never believe writers who say, "No, I don't think about the reader. Oh, if I thought about the reader, you know, that would change my truth that I have to get to on the page." And now you've confirmed my feeling that I shouldn't trust that.
I think part of it was too, it was getting back to the reader that I once was even before I was a writer, and I was a late reader. I didn't start reading till after college. I just remember the feeling of falling in love with a novel and wanting to be inside it and stay inside it, and just, you know, not wanting to put a book down. And there's a magic to that. And I did my best to try to write and to try to get to that, to try to achieve that.
Well, then I have to ask you what you've been reading since you've said that.
Lately, I really haven't had very much time to read at all. But I've actually been rereading. I've been reading a lot of poetry because I was really late to. I felt like I couldn't understand poetry, and so I didn't try to read very much. And I've recently decided that I don't need to understand it. It can keep its mystery, and that's okay. Or I'm just, you know, I'm just not smart enough to get it, but I'm enjoying it. So I've been rereading Lely Long Soldier's Whereas, and I've been slowly reading Tommy Pico's Junk, and Kaveh Akbar, Calling the Wolf a Wolf is another book of poetry. I've just been reading a lot of poetry. The Wound is a World is a book that just got a really prestigious poetry award in Canada. But I'm always terrible when this question gets asked because my mind just goes blank.
No, I'm really, really, your mind was in no way a blank. It's nice to hear you say there's times that I'm reading poetry and I don't get every, I mean, I have that, I'm interviewing the poet. And if I'm reading a book length poem, there's undoubtedly parts of that poem that I feel like the poet was saying, had to be saying, and that it's okay if I don't understand every line or every stanza of what they felt they had to say. Sometimes I think, is this just a cop-out? I'm not trying hard enough. Sometimes I think that's the mystery of poetry, that I don't have to penetrate every single thing that the poet needed to say. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think poetry lends itself to rereading. And a line that you didn't get the first time, when you go back through, it might land. I think it keeping its mystery thing is what I'll settle on, and not that I'm stupid.
Good. Tommy Orange's new novel is called There, There. Thank you.
Thank you.